Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
You can live pretty close to somebody for years and learn you don't actually know that person as well as you thought. Or you can live with somebody and wake up one day and realize you just know them too well. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Anna Quinlan's new novel takes place almost entirely on the charming and rare cul-de-sac of single-family homes where Nora Nolan and her husband raised their two children, now off to college and nearing graduation. The residents know each other's spouses and kids and dogs. They look forward to annual block parties and holiday gatherings. They have good jobs and plenty of money. But parking is a scarce commodity on this block. And when a physical altercation breaks out over access to a members-only parking lot, it changes the way Nora and her husband look at their friends, their marriage, and their lives in the city. The book is called Alternate Side, and Anna Quinlan joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Anna, welcome back to Think.
Chris, it's always so good to be with you.
The very first sign of trouble in a postmodern paradise comes on the first page of this book, and it's so tiny and yet so telling. Nora Nolan's husband, Charlie, is admiring the sight of his car in this parking lot. And the way he phrases his content, three words, punctuated sort of like their own sentences, it's something he's been doing for years, and Nora realizes it, that she finds that annoying.
Well, I think that you sort of get shot out of the cannon of their marriage in that first chapter. And it's not necessarily bad or flawed at that point. It just is. I mean, they've been married for 25 years. And anyone who tells you that they could be married to somebody for 25 years and not have annoyances on both sides, I think is lying.
She thinks to herself that her marriage has become like the AA serenity prayer.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and to so not care otherwise. I mean, look, I think that this is a realistic portrayal of a certain kind of marriage. And I think one of the things that we find so often in novels is either an idealistic portrayal or a really, really bleak portrayal. And I think most marriages, especially long marriages, fall somewhere in between.
One thing I really liked about this is that you didn't have to create a villain here, at least not within the marriage. You know, we're going to see them struggling. I'm not giving away any major plot points there, but we don't have to take sides even as readers, although the book comes from Nora's point of view.
Yeah, but these are both good people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, again, I think that's deeply realistic. Many of us have friends whose marriages have struggled and even broken down. And the tough thing for us is that we look at them and think, I like them both. Do I have to choose sides?
There's that point, too, where you look around and when another couple separates, you think, oh, are we next? Because nothing is so dire in this situation, necessarily.
I know. Don't you sometimes think it's contagious?
Yeah.
The separation, the divorce, that sort of thing. People really fear that. And it's why sometimes when couples split up, they lose their married friends, because people have been used like Noah's Ark to going two by two.
Right.
And when you're a singleton, suddenly you're not a twosome anymore.
So as you know, this show airs all over Texas, which is like land of wide open spaces and free parking. For people who haven't read the book yet, have not lived in a city like New York, help us understand like how a permanent parking space is such a big deal.
You know, early on, people would say to me, Alternate Side, what's this book going to be about? And I'd say, off-street parking and marriage. And my publisher said, don't say the parking thing. It's not really about the parking thing. No one's interested in the parking thing. I mean, to some substantial extent, the parking thing is a metaphor for power and control and because it's mainly the purview of the men on this block, in fact, it's exclusively the purview of the men on this block, it's about potency and where they are on the pecking order. But I mean, in New York City, finding a parking space is a nightmare. There is this thing called alternate side of the street parking, which was the original intent behind the title, although it morphed over the course of writing the book. And that is that you can park on one side of the street on, say, Mondays and Thursdays, and another side of the street on Tuesdays and Fridays. So people are always having to move their cars or buy a garage space, rent a garage space for the amount of money that most people in sane places pay for, say, a one-bedroom apartment, or in rare cases, there are parking facilities in your building or on your block. And this is a block where there's one small parking lot that has a couple of spaces in it that people are kind of willed when someone else moves out. And at the beginning of the book, of course, Charlie Nolan has scored a space in the lot. Having said that, I mean, if alternate side had only worked for parking, it wouldn't be the title of this novel. But luckily, by the time I finished the book, there were so many alternate sides. There was the men and the women on the block who react to things in very different ways, the haves and the have-nots of the block, and the alternate sides of the Nolan's marriage as the book progresses.
You say the women on this block talk about people and the men talk about things.
Yep. I don't think that's exclusive to the block either. I mean, I remember years ago I was asked to invent a column for the New York Times called Life in the 30s. And the editor who gave me the assignment said, write once a week about the things you're talking about with your friends on the telephone. And I used to give a speech in which I would say, you know, I really could have gotten a column out of every phone conversation I had with my girlfriends. And then I would add, if my husband had had to write a column based on his phone conversations, and I never got to finish that sentence because the entire audience would start to laugh. Now, the entire audience was almost exclusively women, mm-hmm. and they sort of got the fact that we unpack our emotional toolkit with our friends in conversation constantly. We're talking about what's going on with our kids. We're talking about what's going on with us, with our parents. The guys we know tend overwhelmingly not to do that. It tends much more to be scheduling, you know. Oh, okay. Meet you at 8. Okay. Mm-hmm. How about those Knicks? That kind of thing. And I think that's reflected in some of the differences between Nora and Charlie.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. You know, my husband goes on a guy's trip with the men of our group of friends, and I go on a girl's trip. And, you know, we spend the whole time talking. And I asked my husband, what do you guys do? And he said, well, we just kind of throw things. Like, in the morning, we'll play bocce and throw a frisbee, and then we'll go have a snack. And in the afternoon, you know, we'll play some other game where you're tossing stuff around. They are communicating, but it's about a different set of things.
Well, I have the same thing going on. My husband, when we're out at the house we have in the country, we'll go running in the morning with a friend of ours. I go out with his wife an hour later, and I'll come back into the kitchen and say, oh my God, can you believe what's going on with them? And Jerry looks at me blankly and says, what? And I say, what do you two talk about? Well, we were talking about these new Asics running shoes that they had. I just think, okay, whatever. Let me fill you in.
But it's hard to say, you know, who's happier? That's an interesting question to ask.
Well, that's true. That's true. Because sometimes, you know, you feel the pain of your friends and walk around with the weight of their world on your shoulders. And maybe that's less likely to happen with our male colleagues and husbands and friends.
So Nora and Charlie and virtually all their neighbors are doing well financially. But Nora has this little secret, which is that she kind of longs for the way New York felt when it was grittier. Things were a little more dangerous. She didn't have as much money. She almost feels like their successes made them forget who they were before.
I think that's true of most people. And it certainly is a different New York today than it was when I came to New York for college and then started working as a tabloid reporter. I mean, there's no question that it was much more dangerous, that it was funkier. But, you know, it's in our big cities that we tend to see income inequality writ really large. You see it in Dallas, you see it in Chicago and LA, and you certainly see it in New York City. And it takes some of the real feel out of daily life. I mean, sort of the middle class is where the action is in America. And when that shrinks, when what you wind up with are prosperous and even very rich people, and the people who make their lives possible. There's a whole middle to things of teachers and nurses and social workers that you don't see or feel on the streets anymore as much as you once did, and that impoverish life, I think.
So I want to talk about Ricky. All the people on this block use the same handyman, and he sort of fixes everything on every house on the street. He's almost like a permanent fixture in the neighborhood. They trust him. He's a good guy. They don't know him as well as they think, and then they maybe assume that they know him. There are class differences that the wealthier residents find it easy to pretend do not exist for them.
Well, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this whole sense of you know, no, he's practically a member of the family. You know, people tell themselves that all the time. They tell themselves that about, you know, the people who help take care of their kids and the people who help take care of their parents in assisted living facilities or nursing homes, or the people who, you know, make their lives possible in a variety of ways. And that's all well and good, except that that when you're paying that person, they're not really a member of the family, are they? And not only should you be aware of that, you should be aware of the fact that they are keenly aware of that.
Yeah. There's this really, I won't give the exact details away, but there's this really stunning moment where Nora realizes something that she's been doing for Ricky that she thought was really like a kind gesture wasn't necessarily taken in that same spirit and didn't mean to him what it meant to her. Like she assumed she knew what he needed and she didn't.
Well, yeah, I think sometimes there's this sense of noblesse oblige, that we don't mean to have rear its ugly head, but it does. These relationships are transactional. And the transaction is that the people who work with us deliver value for money, and we deliver the money. And to breach that, can be a terrible mistake. And Nora makes that mistake. And again, she doesn't make the mistake because she's callous,
right,
or foolish. She makes it because she's a good person who tends to think of everything as a level playing field, except that that's really an illusion.
My guest is journalist and novelist Anna Quindlen. Her new book is called Alternate Side. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Anna Quindlen. Her new novel is called Alternate Side. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Anna, one thing I've always really liked about your novels is that you take these tiny little details that might pass anybody else by, and simply by observing them, you make us think about something. So this handyman, he introduces himself to everybody as Ricky, which is what most people call him. Nora knows that his given name is Enrique, and she insists on calling him that. And we're just left with this tiny little question about whether she's respecting him or maybe unintentionally disrespecting him with this tiny choice where, again, she means to do the right thing.
Exactly. She thinks she's honoring him by referring to him as Enrique, and she makes the kids call him Enrique, too. But he's made the choice to be Ricky, and the question is, shouldn't she go with what he wants?
Yeah, and what's really great about this whole thing is that it's not... the whole story, you know, alternate side, as you said, you have lots of different sides of things. It is and it isn't about a midlife crisis, right? It's more nuanced than that. But you have Charlie coming to grips with the fact that he's not quite as successful as he imagined he might be in his wildest dreams. And Nora fails to understand why that's a big deal because he's really successful.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that this book is about, to my mind, is the difference in which men and women approach aging. I think women are more comfortable with it, in my experience, than men are. The women I know, if they reach a certain point and they've ascended to a certain height, women of my generation are kind of surprised. Oh my gosh, we got to do this because of the expectations that we grew up with. Men who have wanted to be masters of the universe are deeply disappointed when they don't get to do that. And I think that their self-image takes a real hit at a certain age when they realize that they've gone as far as they're going to go, which is what Charlie is beginning to think, in a way that doesn't happen as much with women.
I wonder if women of your daughter's generation will feel that differently.
Well, that's really interesting because we're now in a kind of a petri dish in terms of the lives of men and women. You know, I can't separate out how much of the way I approach my life and my feelings about it are a product of simply living in the world, and how much have to do with straddling that second wave of feminism in the way that I do. Growing up in the 50s and early 60s, when I looked around and sort of thought, there is no place for me in this world. And then suddenly having all the rules change in a way that was really hard for lots of people, but that certainly hugely benefited me. The rules won't have changed with my sons or my daughter. They've grown up with a certain expectation of the way women are, based in some large measure on watching me. I mean, I certainly didn't grow up with a mother who was an opinion columnist for the New York Times. My mother was a wife and mother. She didn't work outside the home. And so the question of whether that kind of societal mandate is gone, and therefore our daughters and sons will have different ways of aging, of coming into their own, of parenting, is really, really interesting to me.
You don't say it specifically, but I had the sense that when Nora thinks privately about how she's done as a mother, she loves her kids very much, maybe compares herself to her sister, there are things that she's realized about her deficiencies that relate to how she was raised and what she witnessed, but I had the sense that she's never told anybody what she's noticed.
I think, like a lot of women, first of all, I think Nora is a very good mother. And the proof is in the pudding. She has two really great kids. Her daughter ritualistically tortures her in the
She's
way
dramatic.
That girls of a certain age do. Her son maybe holds back from her in the way certain kinds of boys do, but they're good kids. Mm-hmm. I do think, first of all, that she's been perplexed by seeing, you know, she says, my story is the opposite of every dead mother story you've ever heard, which is her mother died when she was relatively young. Her father remarried to somebody who was much better at being a mother than Nora's mother had been. And her sister, who's younger than she is, has reaped the benefits of that. So she does have that kind of confusion. And I also think she's part of a generation of women who judge themselves harshly in terms of mothering. I mean, the cult of the perfect mother in our society is so pernicious. You know, you should be on top of every little thing. You should never have a harsh word. You should know everything about your children. I think some of it is not only pernicious for women, I think it's pernicious for kids. You know, my mother never once in her entire life with me looked at my homework. And somehow I have managed to prosper in the world.
Despite the odds, right? I love that she worries, Nora worries, that she doesn't worry enough about her son.
Right. Rachel, her daughter, who, as you said, is very dramatic, soaks up so much of her time and attention that Oliver, who just sort of tootles along, you know, figuring out chemical experiments and knowing physics theorems, somehow flies a little bit under her radar. And I actually think by the end of the book, you, the reader, are a little more concerned about how he's going to deal going forward than you are about Rachel, who seems to have gotten over some sort of psychic hump.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Joyce is calling from Houston. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. It feels like I've lived kind of a parallel life, but I was a geek. My husband was an engineer. We divorced after 41 years of marriage and after raising the kids, and so many of the factors are absolutely the same. I was much more successful. It really played on him in midlife. Guys talked about it to him, guys who had lesser income, wives who didn't work. So I think society has a lot of growing up to do because it's the women's time. We're dominating, and we should.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, yay. But second of all, here's the thing that I love about reading. I'm a devoted, inveterate reader. And the thing I love about reading is it makes us understand that we're all much more alike than different. So the idea that your caller in Houston could call and make that comment about these fictional characters in this novel bears out that point. And I think it's why reading is really the act that can transcend the lines among and between us. I mean, it's the ultimate tool of tolerance. You know, you read The Bluest Eye or Beloved, and suddenly you understand what it's like to be a Black woman in a way that's impossible if you've grown up as a white woman in our society. Not completely, not down to the ground, but you get this sense of having walked in someone else's shoes that is invaluable in a country that is as riven by differences as ours is right now.
Some In some corners, it's unfashionable to write about wealthy white people who have problems that are not existential necessarily. And yet there's a lot here to understand, to compare to your own life, to just sort of think about and sit with. I wonder if you thought, if you worried at all that people would be bothered by the fact that on the surface, at least, these people have no problems.
I can't imagine any of my readers are naive enough to think that because you have money, you don't have problems. Hmm. And anybody who's read Edith Wharton knows that the haves are also have-nots. But this isn't just a story of these prosperous people on the block. It's also the story of the people who are working class people who make their lives possible. And I think that dynamic is essentially interesting. Whether we're talking about the dynamic in a restaurant or a hospital or any of the other places where there's that kind of dynamic, that kind of pecking order. So I didn't really think twice about it, Chris. I've got to be honest with you. Each of my novels is a reaction in some ways to the one that went before. Mm-hmm. And my last novel, Miller's Valley, was about a rural farming family in the middle of nowhere. So making the shift to professional people in New York City felt right to me.
I also love the relationship between Nora and the woman who has been her children's nanny, and then the kids are gone, but she's still sort of around. And I have the feeling that she sees a lot of interesting things and has a lot of opinions that she only occasionally shares with the family.
Yeah, but Charity is her name, and Charity is sort of the weather vane of everything on the block.
Right.
I mean, Nora says she finds out that one couple are getting a divorce or another couple are moving out because Charity comes home and tells her. She's the intelligence on the block. And that's because she's sort of moving among the other people who take care of these people on the block and who frankly, who know their secrets. I mean, you know, if you have somebody who is, you know, doing your laundry and helping to raise your kids, they know stuff about you that you may prefer to gloss over, or you may kid yourself they don't know, but boy, do they see.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Anna Quindlen. Her new novel is called Alternate Side. I love the job that you give Nora. She's head of this museum of jewelry, which is completely disrespected by like the fine arts institutions in the city because it was started as kind of a vanity project. But people love it. Like people want to go and see
all this
beautiful jewelry. So talk a little bit. First of all, it's a fun metaphor, right? Like, is jewelry valuable because it's beautiful or because it's made out of rare materials?
Well, and as Bibi, who helped found the museum based on, in part on her own collection, says, you know, if people think it's real, what does it matter if it's real or not? I mean, I love the conversation between Nora and her sister Christine when Bibi first approaches Nora about doing this, and Nora says it's ridiculous. And there's a long silence, and then Christine said, it's fantastic. It will be huge. And Nora says, why would anybody want to, you know, go in and look at this jewelry? You can just go into Tiffany. And her sister says to her, no, whenever I go in there, I feel like a shoplifter. You know, it's
right.
it's that idea of that kind of aspirational, which is what her sister calls it, kind of this aspirational lifestyle. But it's also ridiculous. And even Nora kind of thinks it's ridiculous. At the same time that they're, you know, they're showing people in every morning in huge numbers, almost exclusively female, who like the idea of just looking at this stuff.
So there's this panhandler who has taken up residence outside the museum, and he's not actually homeless. And he and Nora have this really interesting relationship because he is like, he's like an oracle, right?
He is an oracle.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about him.
He's like the Dalai Lama, Phil. He's just, he's almost a mythical character to me.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of guy who has stopped caring what society thinks of him. We don't really know that much about him. It seems likely that he actually does have a home, but we're not 100% certain. We're not 100% certain of his backstory. And he doesn't care whether you're certain of it or not. He just has these constant exchanges with Nora because, unlike her boss, she hasn't tried to get him to get the police or someone to move him along. And like Charity, he sees a lot. And so he's well aware of it. He's well aware of Nora's route to work. He's well aware of the kind of mood she's in. He's aware of it when she decides to make a change in her professional situation. And they have a really easy relationship based on the fact that they're not in each other's lives, that they pass like ships in the night. And there's a certain kind of relationship that people in New York develop that's like that. The guy who runs the register at the coffee shop where you have breakfast two or three times a week. The woman behind the counter at the dry cleaner. We see these people on such a regular basis that we have a kind of a cordial relationship with them that's not quite friendship, but they're not exactly strangers. My husband coined a term at one point for the people that you always saw on the same train every morning. He said they were familiar strangers.
Hmm.
And I think Nora and Phil are much more than that, but they're less than friends. And I just every time he came on stage in the novel for me, I was happy because I really liked him too.
My guest is author Anna Quindlen. Her new novel is called Alternate Side. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can send an email to think@kera.org or leave us a message on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Anna Quindlen about her new novel, Alternate Side. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. So, Anna, Nora is a transplant to the city like almost everybody she knows. She was drawn to kind of the romance of New York, but she remains aware that there are certain affectations involved with becoming a New Yorker. So, like, she notices people who grew up in Kansas City now air kiss like Parisians.
There are endless affectations in New York. I mean, you just can't get over it. Socially, in terms of how your daily life is supposed to go, I mean, I like the fact that Nora is finally past the point where she's giving dinner parties, where everybody did what she thought of as competitive cooking. I mean, those years are all blur to me now. You know, there are still the times where you bring cupcakes to school for somebody's birthday and pretend that you made them yourself when, in fact, they came from a bakery and you just mushed up the icing with a knife.
She assumes, based on her own perspective, that like her kids are so lucky to be New York natives. And it turns out her daughter, at least, is drawn to living elsewhere. There's nothing exotic about New York to her.
Well, that's true. And you see that with some New York kids, although they do tend to circle around. Two of my three live in the city now, and I think we'll be three for three pretty soon if my youngest has her way. And it is nice when they graduate from college, because then all their friends who are from other parts of the country wind up in New York. But I think with her daughter, too, some of it is wanting to be her own person. And her mother having such a strong identification with the city that she decides to go elsewhere, which is a manifestation that people all over the country are familiar with and that isn't particular to New York. In fact, one of the things that I found really cheering being on book tour with this novel is how many people have said to me, this reminds me so much of my neighborhood in Philadelphia, or this reminds me of so much of my neighborhood in Chicago. And recently I did an event at which a woman said to me, listen, don't kid yourself. What you talk about here, it's not a city thing. It's a neighborhood thing. I live on a cul-de-sac in the suburbs, and so much of what you're describing, except for the parking, is is our birthright, too.
If you'd like to join the conversation with my guest, Anna Quinlan, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. When you think about characters, I mean, do you start out with one and then the other sort of attach themselves? Or how does your framework of human beings whose lives you're going to write about come together?
It always starts with my protagonist. Mm-hmm. I usually spend 5 or 6 months of what I think of as walking around time, which really is the morning when I'm either running or walking really fast for about an hour in the park near my house. And during that time, slowly but surely, a character starts to take shape in my head, in this case, Nora. And over time, I know what her birth order is, what she does for a living, how many kids she has, of course, who she's married to, if she's married, all the rest of it. And usually by the time I finally sit down to write, it's because not only do I now know about her, not everything, but a lot, but I also know about the solar system of her family and friends. And that's the moment when things start to happen, because, of course, plot is just characters who are bumping up against each other.
Maybe that's why your books always feel so real, because even the fact that not only do we have Nora and her neighbors, but we have her with her, I don't know if she'd call them her real girlfriends. She doesn't necessarily know them better, but, you know, they're people outside the neighborhood that she hangs around with, and she has different kinds of conversations with them.
Absolutely. I mean, I really am only interested in character. I always feel like plot is reductive, and the only way that it authentically happens for me is when two characters are at loggerheads, or a group of characters against one in the course of the action of the novel. But again, I don't even think about the action of the novel. I think about these people inhabiting a place, talking to one another, going about their business. And if I've picked the moment right in their lives, plot will ensue because of what's going on with all of them.
We have the sense of, you know, this neighborhood. At the time that Nora is there, we have the sense that she's the heart of it. It's like, I was thinking a little bit about going back to your old school, right? Like you go back and visit and you're not there anymore, and the people that you know may or may not still be there. It's the same, and yet it's different, and yet it feels right to be gone.
Yeah, and that happens in the city a lot. On a regular basis, just because, let's say, you grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia and now you live in New York City, which actually describes me. There's not a whole lot of opportunity for me to pass by the house where I grew up when I was a kid unless I make a special pilgrimage. On the other hand, it's real easy for me to walk past the building where I had my first apartment after college, because it just happens to be near a lot of it. It's near the offices of NPR station WNYC. So when I go down there, I almost always walk right past the building where I lived right after college. And that's true of a lot of people in New York, that you walk by and suddenly think, oh gosh, that's the building where my best friend lived before she met so-and-so, and then they got married and moved to the other side of town, that kind of thing. Because there is so much life that takes place just moving around the streets of New York.
Do you feel protective of that building where your first apartment was after college?
I wouldn't say I feel protective of it, but I feel like I can walk through those rooms effortlessly. With my eyes closed. And I certainly think my kids will feel that way about the house where they grew up. I mean, you know, there's that moment at the end in which Phil, the guy who sits out front of the museum panhandling, says New York is a city of the mind. And Nora says, Who are you, really, city of the mind? Am I going to wind up in a doctoral dissertation about people who give money on the streets? And Phil says, you never gave me any money. But the truth is that's sort of true, that all of your past lives exist often within either walking or subway distance of you in a way that might not be true if you grew up in other parts of the country.
This book made me think a lot about the fact that there are cities whose residents are constantly trying to knock away at the mythology that everybody else has created about them. And there are cities whose residents are really invested in perpetuating that mythology.
Well, I think in the case of New York City, the answer is both.
Really?
I'm always amazed by the mythology that New Yorkers are cold and unfriendly. I mean, the number of times that I've stopped in Central Park in front of people who are turning a map around or looking plaintively at their iPhones and said, so where are you? The Guggenheim? Okay, just keep going in this direction, and then you'll take a left when you get to Fifth Avenue. I mean, New Yorkers can be almost painfully helpful if the need arises, but the need has to sort of conspicuously arise. And so I think we like to demythologize some of that, but some of the mythology is inevitable. I mean, when you walk down a block in this city and you see a whole line of black cars whose drivers are waiting for somebody to get in the back seat, you can only conclude that in some places, New York is a city of the very rich. But that's true in a lot of American cities now, to their peril, in my opinion.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I was struck by Charlie's realization, and Nora's as well, that had he lived somewhere else, he would not have felt less than very successful.
It's absolutely true. I mean, Charlie's a smart guy, and he's really nice. People really like working with him. He's very capable. If he'd lived in kind of a smallish city or town someplace, he probably would have been the president of the local bank. Chairing, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, something like that. But, you know, there's what seem like a million hyperannuated professional people in New York City. And inevitably, that means that some of them are going to sort of wind up treading water around the middle, the high middle. Boy, the high middle in New York City has a lot of rewards to it. But again, if you were hoping to make it in some way to the top, it's a hard place to do that for anybody. I mean, you know, I'm always struck by the fact that I run into novelists who live in smaller places and smaller towns and cities, and they're sort of treated as
like royalty,
celebrities in those places. But I mean, New York City is a place where you could run into any of dozens of really accomplished writers on the street, on the subway, and there's a lot of sort of paying you no never mind.
It sounds like you share Nora's love for the city.
Oh my God. I have four uncomplicated relationships in my life. Three of them are with my children, and one of them is with New York. And I cannot tell, I really cannot tell you why. I mean, it was like, I was 18 years old. I was coming out of the subway one day. I looked up and suddenly was hit by the realization that I was in the place I was always meant to be. And whether that's metabolism or the need for writers to be surrounded by humanity so that they can cull things, so that they can save the string of conversation and appearance and grind it up later to put it in a novel, I don't know. But I don't really have any mixed emotions about New York.
Do you feel the need to defend it? I mean, even one of the key tensions between Nora, and Charlie is that he's tired. Like it's a lot of, there's a lot of inconvenience that goes along with it, and she just can't get enough of it. Are there friends in your life that are like, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
I think the friends in my life who had that feeling had it, say, 25 or 30 years ago. Mm. I mean, you know, there was a lot of, I don't want to send my kids to private school. I don't want them to have to deal with the dirt and noise. I want grass and trees. You know, we're moving to the suburbs. And a lot of people we know did that. The interesting thing for us now that so many of them are in their 60s, is we keep running into people on the street who moved to the suburbs, and now that their kids are grown, are moving back to the city. I mean, the city's a great place to sort of be older because there's always something going on. You can walk to everything. There's lots to do. But actually, that's why it was a really good place to raise kids, too. I mean, you know, I never sat at home at night and thought, my 16-year-old is out driving a car. If my 16-year-old was in a car, it was a yellow car. They were sitting in the back seat, and the big worry was whether they were going to have enough to pay the cab fare.
And I guess now it's all Uber, right? There's not as many. The yellow cab is not quite so ubiquitous as it once was.
I actually am trying single-handedly to save the New York City cab industry. You know, it used to be really hard to get a cab at certain times of the day or in certain weather. Now it's not. But, you know, yellow cab drivers are really struggling at this point. So I'm like the last living person who's putting my hand up in the air.
The new novel by author Anna Quindlen is called Alternate Side. Anna, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us again.
Thanks, Chris. It was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast on any podcast app, and you can also find a stream of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.